The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I started exploring some of the Buddhist teachings on how we cling to our experience. And I just want to recap a little bit to set a context, to set a framework for this discussion. You know, the Buddha was really interested in understanding why we suffer. You know, what's going on here? He thought, you know, why is it that we, you know, wanting to be happy, trying to be happy, we still end up struggling and suffering? And so his whole exploration, his whole teaching is exploring that question. And in his own practice, his own search of this, the answer to this question, he found that it is possible to be free of suffering. And all of his teachings are directed to helping also us understand how we might see that for ourselves. It's not a teaching. His teachings are not just kind of theoretical teachings to be thought about, but are meant to be put into practice so that we can see for ourselves the possibility of how we might too be free from the ways that we struggle, the ways that we suffer, the ways that we feel stress. The suffering that the Buddha was exploring, he saw, I think, pretty quickly in his exploration that there's going to be some physical, there's going to be circumstances in the world and circumstances of body that will not be likable to us, that will not be pleasant. And that those are just going to be there. Those are going to come and go. Sometimes things will be pleasant, sometimes things will be unpleasant. And that he saw that what we, the way we struggle with that, is that essentially we try to kind of stop the flow of experience and say, this configuration, please, let's hold on to this one. I like this one. That we maybe get to a place where we find a way to feel okay about ourselves for even a few moments. And in that, we want to stop the flow. We want to say, this is it. I figured it out. And how do I keep this? And the Buddha recognized that the conditions of the world are just endlessly changing, and that it is not our fault that we can't hold on to that. And that the suffering that we experience comes in the form of the trying to hold on, the trying to stop the flow. So this is the clinging. Essentially, we... this notion of trying to hold on to a certain configuration of experience, of ideas, of sense pleasure, that kind of stopping of the flow of experience is running counter to what's actually happening, which is that things are endlessly changing. And so with this trying to say, oh, this one, trying to solidify this one for even a few moments, we are essentially running counter to reality. We are not in alignment with the way things are. And in not being in alignment with the way things are, that is really where our suffering is born. If we could actually be in alignment with reality, and this is what the Buddha is said to have discovered for himself, that being in alignment with the fact that things change, with the endless stream, the endless flow, with the not trying to stop up the works, that he experienced a deep, deep peace and a deep happiness. The ending of the way that we, in our minds, it's a mental movement to try to hold on to a certain configuration of experience. And so in discovering that it's something happening in our minds, this stopping of the flow, he said it's possible to change our minds. It's a good thing. It's possible. And actually, the way that we suffer, the other piece of this, he said, the way that we suffer is essentially created by our own minds. And that's good news, too, because the fact that it's created in our own minds means there's a possibility for change, that coming into alignment with things as they are is a shift of mind. It's not a shift of circumstance in the world. There's a way in which we can be at peace, at ease, with whatever is happening in the world. And in a way, you know, what we think of as being at peace, at being at ease, often we get an image of ourselves as just sitting there or, you know, not doing anything, something like that. But the peace, the ease of the Buddha is not passive. It acts. It engages in the world in a way that understands this flow, this never-ending stream. And the movement of the peaceful heart comes from wisdom, from compassion, from love, from generosity, rather than from hating things or wanting to hold on to things or fix things or change things. The fixing and changing, the wanting to fixing and change often comes out of a sense of not liking. I don't like this, it's got to be fixed. Whereas the movement to act from a peaceful heart is often motivated by compassion, by a sense of wishing to alleviate suffering, but also understanding that circumstances are as they are. So it's kind of a paradox in a way. And I just there's a kind of a leap of faith we have to make around this notion that becoming peaceful and at ease with the circumstances of our lives, of the world, doesn't mean that we become a blob. It actually means that our hearts are more open and more resonant and more responsive to the world. I'd say we become responsive rather than reactive. So in terms of understanding this mental stopping of the works, the Buddha kind of, I think in his own exploration of looking at this question of suffering, started not by trying to find a way to not suffer, but rather by looking at the suffering itself. He was kind of a scientist of mind. He said, let's look at the suffering and see if we can understand what causes that suffering. And then if it's possible to change the conditions of the cause, then the suffering won't follow. And so that was his exploration, to study the suffering, to get really familiar with how the mind, the various ways the mind tries to stop up the works. And in that exploration, that very understanding actually begins to point the way to the letting go. What I've seen in my own practice so many times is that when the mind really understands the suffering itself, through the exploration, through the meeting of the suffering, when the mind really understands that, I think because the kind of the way we're put together, the natural movement of our organism is towards well-being. And yet, because we're not really present for the flow of experience and really present for what's going on in our minds, our idea of well-being is very short-sighted. It becomes focused on this 2 seconds of experience and trying to hold on to it for as long as we can, as opposed to understanding more deeply the conditions for a deeper kind of happiness. So the exploration of the suffering itself with mindful attention, with an understanding that having what we want isn't the way to happiness, you know, that we begin to see through this exploration of our experience that having what we want feels good for a few moments, and then as that goes away or we get adjusted to that, or, you know, it's been with us for a little while, you know, we kind of loses its glow, and then we want that feeling of having something and having control, and so we go looking for something else to want. And we start to see the kind of unsatisfactory nature of the way that we thought happiness came to be. And we start, you know, being willing to explore things in a different way, to explore the possibility of looking at, understanding our suffering. And that very understanding begins to free us. Not so much something that we can do, but the understanding itself, as the mind meets the way it holds on, because the organism is inclined towards well-being. When the mind sees that the holding on itself is not supportive of well-being, the mind itself starts to let go. And you don't have to believe that. I just ask that you explore your experience. See what happens as you explore your experience. So one of the teachings about exploring this suffering, the Buddha talked about clinging as being essentially, you know, that way we try to stop up the flow. And he offered a teaching on four different ways that we tend to cling to experience. And an understanding of these ways we tend to cling to experience can help us in meeting our experience, understanding it from a new perspective. So these four ways of clinging are clinging to sense pleasure, which is this kind of very familiar sense of liking to have pleasant things around us, wanting to get rid of unpleasant things, and just the kind of orientation that we have to thinking that our happiness will come from having sense pleasure in our lives. That is, in fact, I mean, we realize that perhaps it's not the best kind of pleasure in a way, but, you know, what we think is that if we can only arrange our lives, maybe we know that we can't keep this one, but if we can arrange our lives like a string of events, one after the other, of pleasant things, that would be happiness. So the clinging to sense pleasure, actually the Buddha pointed to that clinging itself being the kind of the root or the place where the suffering is born. That the clinging kind of locks that suffering into place. And clinging to wanting things to be pleasant, wanting to get rid of things that are unpleasant. Clinging is the stopping of the flow of experience. So the clinging is what's not in alignment with reality. It doesn't mean that we try to push away sense pleasure. This teaching on letting go of the clinging around sense pleasure doesn't mean that we try to push away sense pleasure. In fact, what I've seen through allowing the flow of experience, allowing the flow of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral to kind of just wash through instead of saying, oh, more of that, less of that, instead of having that kind of orientation, there's a way in which the non-clinging, either the not clinging to hold on to pleasure or get rid of unpleasant, the pleasure of simple things like the sound of the bird. You know, can we just be with the sound of the bird? You know, that without clinging to experience, the small pleasures that wash through us are actually, in a way, experienced more fully. We gain a sense of appreciation of just the simple joys of life, more of a sense of the delight in just how things come and go, and in the not trying to get rid of or push away the unpleasant. We see that a lot of our difficulty around the unpleasant is that there's a multiplication effect when we don't like something that's unpleasant. The not liking itself, the aversion, the trying to get rid of, the hating it, the frustration, the irritation, all of that's unpleasant too. And that mental reactivity multiplies the actual, whatever actual unpleasantness there is. So this clinging around sense pleasure is the first way that the Buddha talked about how we cling to experience. And I talked about that more last week, so I won't go into it too much now. And these next two also I'll just kind of briefly review, and then I want to get to the fourth one. So the second one is clinging to views. That we have ideas about who we are, who other people are, how the world should be. And we see the world through those views and kind of assess the world through those views. So many different ways of holding views, you know, views about ourselves, who I am, what I'm capable of, views about other people, who they are, what they're like, views about society, views about nature, what's right, what's wrong. So we hold views, and then we often in those views, they coalesce into beliefs and become what's right. In that holding to something as right makes something else wrong. And this is, again, where a lot of our suffering comes from, that we get in contention with people and experiences when they're not in alignment with our views. So, again, we know we're going to live with views. Views are really useful in our lives. And just they help us to kind of navigate the world. And yet we hold to them. We congeal around them. We take them to be some kind of reality or inherent truth rather than recognizing this is a view. This is a belief. This is what the Buddha asked us to do, to recognize essentially believing is happening here. So often with views, we do not see that they are constructed in our minds. We take them to be just the way it is. I'm a miserable person. That's just the way it is. Boy, I sure believed that. You know, and when I did experience some kind of happiness, I was like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but, you know, what I really am is miserable. You know, not really able to take in the happiness as being, you know, a legitimate part of the experience because I was so identified with the miserable. And so a view, and this actually points to the other piece I want to talk about. So recognizing our views becomes a key here. Looking, you know, noticing when we are engaged in the world through views. And this is a kind of a iterative process. It's a process that, you know, first we see perhaps one layer of views. And then those views, you know, it's like we see that it's a view through watching our experience and essentially, like for instance, that example around miserable person and happy. You know, looking at experience long enough, you begin to see that there's kind of a flow of stuff happening, and that, well, that idea of miserable, that miserable, I'm a miserable person, that it's just an idea, and that there's an awful lot of times when miserable isn't happening. And so it begins to undermine, like poke holes, the mindfulness begins to poke holes in the view as a solidity. So the believing begins to diminish. So recognizing our views, you know, what I've seen is that we may begin to see that they're views, but still be caught by them. So at least now we're seeing that they're a view, but we still recognize that we believe it. But this is the step. At least we see that it's a view, and we can see that there's believing happening. So this is the exploration, turning our attention to what is being believed here. That's a great question. What is the belief? If there's suffering happening, again, this whole thing is around suffering. If there's suffering happening, there's some kind of view going on that's probably not clearly seen. So when there's some kind of suffering, what's the belief? What's the view? Just see if you can begin to tap into that and see it as a view. This, again, you know, views are going to happen. What the Buddha said is clinging to views is the issue, not the having of views. Views can be useful as long as they're understood as mental constructs, not truth. The third kind of clinging is clinging to what's called rites and rituals or rules and observances. And this is, I think really, in a way, it's rooted very much in the time of the Buddha, because there were certain religious sects that believed that certain actions would lead to freedom. You know, like bathing in the river Ganges, that inherently was going to wash away the impurities of our minds. And the Buddha said that there's no particular action. You know, if we think a certain form is going to free us, then we're not understanding how the mind works. That, we might think, you know, sitting cross-legged or sitting still, that would be freedom. And the Buddha actually said something like, you know, if sitting still were freedom, then a chicken would be free because, you know, chickens sit still for a long time to hatch their eggs. You know, so it's not just about the sitting. It's not just about stillness. So this is the exploration again. You know, is there something that you're doing without looking at the intention behind it? Are you just doing it out of rote? That's the exploration here. Are we clinging to something as being something good to do just in and of itself, rather than understanding the intention behind what we're doing? Much of what the Buddha taught was that the intention behind our actions is what leads to the consequences being either wholesome or unwholesome. That if our intentions are motivated by greed, aversion, delusion, unwholesome, that leads us to the path towards more suffering. And intentions motivated by kindness, by wisdom, by compassion, by non-greed, by non-aversion, by non-delusion, tends to lead us more towards happiness. And so he points us to look at the mind again. It's not just about bodily action. It's about looking at the mind. So all of his teachings really point back to look at the mind. How is the mind in this situation? The last of the clingings is clinging to identity view, which is a form of view. I talked about views a minute ago, and what I was exploring in terms of a view, I am miserable, that's an identity view. Identity view kind of being a kind of a subset of views that we cling to, but it was such an important way of clinging that the Buddha highlighted it. This kind of clinging goes so deep. That sense that I am, the sense of self, is so deeply embedded in our psyche. It's hard to fathom what the Buddha teaches, which is that is simply a view. The idea of me is a concept. It's an idea. It's not a reality. It's not a thing. It's very hard to see this. And it actually seems to be more hard in a way to take this. This is one of the hardest teachings to take in with our mind, you know, with our reasoning. Because the reason, by the part of the reason why this is so hard, is because our habit of thinking, our habit of how we take in information is so oriented by this view, this filter, that, you know, our thoughts, most of our thoughts are structured around I am, I have, I want, I need. This is me, this is mine. So the structure of the whole way we take in information comes in through this sense of self. And so it's like very hard for that sense of self to take in information that runs counter to that perspective. So you don't have to believe this. I'm going to offer some things that may help to jar this a little bit. You don't have to believe it, but what the Buddha suggested is to look at what do you call self? What is it? I mean, often actually when you go looking for it, it's awfully hard to pin down. You know, it's like you can't really find it. There's a feeling of me. But if you try to say, that's it, it's changing. It's already something else. This very exploration of the not finding points to the very deep truth that there's nothing to find. So the Buddha suggested, and he offered many different ways. He said, you know, there's so many different ways that we create this, coalesce around this sense of self. Kind of one of the main ones is, I am something. I am strong, I am intelligent, I am miserable, I am depressed, I am unworthy, I am not seen. I am a mother, I am a father. So there's so many different ways that we identify with being something. You know, we that sense of self becomes equated with some role, some emotion, some mental function. So, you know, roles, you know, I'm angry, I'm miserable, emotions. I'm angry, I'm miserable, I'm happy. We very often identify with those things, that it really feels like I am that emotion. I'm the one who always gets angry. I'm the one who is always frustrated or depressed. So that in the seeing of that, you know, kind of thought or belief, part of the exploration here is hold it. See if you can hold it as, okay, you know, that's what it feels like, but let's look at it. What is it to actually look at this sense of being the one who is miserable? You look at that and you see there's sensation in the body happening around that. There are thoughts in the mind happening around that. But try to find the one who is miserable. You're not going to find it. You will find experience, changing experience, that it's kind of like a mist of stuff. In the texts they talk about the way change seems to become solidified is kind of like, you know, if you take a fire stick, a stick that has fire on the end. And when I was a kid, we did this with sparklers. I don't know if you're all familiar with sparklers, you know. Whirl it around in a circle, and it looks like it becomes a circle of light in the air. You move it fast enough, and it looks like that fire stick becomes an image of a circle. So the Buddha said the sense of self is kind of like that. There's this kind of coalescing of changing experience that gets solidified, or it gets the idea of it as being something is created. And that is then identified as I am. I am this. So in a very real sense, the sense of self is an afterthought. There's a lot of experience happening. The mind experiences those things and then creates this idea of self around it. So it's a construct that comes after the fact. And the willingness to look at our experience moment by moment, this is the unfolding flow of experience, and seeing the change of experience, being willing to take in, oh, happiness is arising, happiness is like this, lightness in the body, a pleasant experience in the mind, sense of joy, sense of ease, begins to poke holes in the solidity of that sense of self, that idea of self. If you start to look at what you take to be self, I began this exploration early in my practice, like, what is it that I take to be self? I began to see there were some very familiar patterns of roles, of emotions that felt, I mean, just they had happened so many times. Miserable was one of them. A feeling of self-hatred was one of them. Feeling really competent and intelligent was one of them. And in looking at these various senses of self, and being a partner with somebody was one of them, and the whole kind of collection of emotions that went with being a partner, looking at these various senses of self, I saw that what I took to be self were basically just very familiar coalescings of experience, ones that happened quite a bit. But in looking at them, I saw, you know, there's actually not much relationship between, for example, the sense of me that is competent and able to write a computer program skillfully, easily, and the sense of me that is miserable. They're just like unrelated to each other. And this is what we start to see, that our senses of self are just, you know, arisings in the moment. Things arise in the moment, and then we attribute self to that arising. very familiar. Our conditioning, the way we've lived in our lives, what our parents reinforced, what our schools reinforced, what our friends reinforced, the patterns, the habits of mind, those tend to be what we coalesce the sense of self around. So this is one of the biggest ways to begin to explore self. You know, we look at what we are taking to be self, particularly when there is suffering. You know, the whole construct of selfing, there's another teaching that the Buddha offered where he described how the sense of self comes to be, a whole kind of series of causes and conditions which leads to this sense of self. He described that whole in a long chain of experience, a long chain of, not experience, of conditioned arising. He said there's this set of conditioned arisings that lead to this sense of self. And that very same set of conditions that leads to a sense of self also describes the conditions that lead to suffering arising. There's this same pattern. The clinging, the holding, the contracting around self and the suffering described by the same process. So if you study suffering, where you are suffering, you are essentially studying the self. Sometimes we can have a sense very clearly of identification, of I am something. You know, there's a real sense, like self-righteousness is a good one to feel that. You know, there's a real strong sense of I am. I'm right. You know, it comes with a really strong sense of self. Other times the sense of self, or like trying to find, well, what is the sense of self here? It feels pretty nebulous. It's not so clear. And yet if we are suffering, if there's a sense of contraction, of unease, of stress, of being unsatisfied in any way, looking at that, looking at the stress, the dissatisfaction, the unease, looking at that is essentially equivalent to looking at self. So whatever's more clear to you, if the suffering side of experience is more clear to you, explore that. Be mindful of that. As I said at the beginning of the talk, you know, understanding suffering allows the mind to know and learn how to let go of it. If it feels like a sense of self is strong, we can investigate that. What is this sense of self? Other ways that we have this identity view around owning things, possessing things. This is mine. Body is mine. Things belong to me. My car, my house, my partner, my job. Just another kind of the sense of possessiveness. And this tends to create suffering because that ownership, I think with that sense of ownership, that we should have control over that thing. Right? That's part of what having ownership means, that I should be able to do with it what I want to do. So when we find the circumstances of reality being what they are, that we don't necessarily have, I mean, we have some level of control over certain things, like this body, for instance, you know. There is an agency in the stream of conditions in this body. There's choice that arises, so that choice can choose to move. I can decide, choose, pick up the glass. So this actually comes back to, I skipped over in the I am something. We often identify or think we are the one who chooses. at a deeper level than emotions or roles. At a deeper level, one of the identifications that's uncovered is that I am the one who decides. I am the one in control of this body and mind. I'm the one who chooses. And again, you know, there is choice happening. But what we see, this is one of the key explorations the Buddha made around selfing. He said, look at the constituent components of the body and mind. There's the body, and then there's stuff happening in the mind. You know, basically that's what we are, a kind of a mixture of body and mental processes happening. And he said, look at these, you know, there's consciousness, there's the body, there's the feeling of things, there's the way our mind constructs things and chooses and decides. These are the various processes of the flow of our being. And he said, look at these. Can you say, may my feeling be thus? May my feeling not be thus? May my body be thus? May my body not be thus? We have some measure of ability to choose, but not absolute control over our mind and body processes. You see this when you sit down to meditate, you know? I am going to sit here and meditate. This is my choice. I choose to be with the breath. I choose to be present in this moment. I choose not to have my mind wander. It doesn't work. So there's some agency at times, and that we identify strongly with that agency as being me, I, who I am. And we feel like there's something wrong with me when I can't control the mind. If I can't stop the mind from wandering, it's a problem. It's my fault. It demonstrates, actually, I mean, this is one of the key pieces of evidence for us that's hard to take in. It demonstrates the truth of not self, that we don't have control over our minds. Every time your mind wanders, every time the mind wakes up, oh, that's another one. You know, the mind wakes up. You've been wandering, lost in some argument. You know, 3 years ago, the mind's been churning around in that, and suddenly it's like, poop, here I am, sitting back in the meditation hall. Who did that? Who woke up? It just happened. Causes and conditions led to the arising of mindfulness. Causes and conditions lead to the disappearance of mindfulness. Every time you sit and watch your mind wander, you are seeing evidence of not-self. Hard to take in, but so well, I'll just explore a little on this teaching of not-self just for a couple minutes. The Buddha said there's something happening here. You know, it's what people get confused about, I think, is that, well, you know, if there isn't any self, then who chooses or who feels or, you know, it becomes confusing. The mind gets confused partly because it is a sense of self trying to take in this teaching on not self. The Buddha said there's something happening here. There's in a mind-body process, there is a stream. There's a flow of conditions, and there's a kind of a continuity, a lawful unfolding of that stream. It's not random. It's not, you know, that suddenly with this understanding of not self that I become someone else. That stream of causes and conditions, the stream of conditioning, the stream of the choices that have been made in this mind-body process continue to unfold in a very lawful way. It's very like a tree growing. You know, if you have an acorn and you plant that acorn in the ground, you give it conditions of sun and water and maybe put a cage around it. I think you have to do that with oak trees because deer will come along and eat down the little shoot. So if you give it conditions that allow the process of that acorn to naturally unfold, it will send a shoot into the ground, it will send sprouts up. There's no being in that tree. I think we can have a sense of that, that it's a natural unfolding. It's the law of nature that that acorn has the capacity to become a tree and does so in a natural unfolding process based on conditions of getting the warmth, the sun, the water, the protection from creatures eating it. It will become a tree. At what point does it really become a tree? At what point does it stop being a tree? It's the idea of tree kind of stops the flow. The concepts we have kind of, we relate to things from the perspective of concept instead of from that perspective of flow. And because that those flows sometimes, you know, the tree, you know, each day it's a little different. Each day there's new sap coming through the tree. Each day there's new cells in the tree. Each day there's, you know, something different about the leaves. So it changes in a very natural unfolding process. But we don't see that change so much because it's happening slowly for one thing, and because we're looking at it from perspective of tree. So the Buddha said something similar about this mind and body. It's a very natural unfolding flow, and there is a flow there. It's not that the flow doesn't exist, but we misperceive, we misidentify, we create the idea of there being a thing, me, rather than a process of unfolding flow, unfolding experience. And this misunderstanding, the Buddha said, was really a key reason why we suffer. Because out of this misunderstanding, out of this thinking that I am, I have, I can control, comes a whole host of confusion. The sense of me wants to have things that make me happy. The sense of me wants to control the world to have it satisfy this sense of self. So this is a kind of a very deep-seated clinging in our minds. And so it's not something that you hear once and, oh, see it kind of automatically. But this perspective of looking at where do we suffer? Where do we try to stop this flow? Begins to help us to see the ways in which we are misperceiving the world, not aligned with reality, not aligned with the way things actually are. And in not being aligned with the way things actually are, suffering over it, believing, I should have control, I should be able to fix things or change things to be the way I want them to be. And thinking that there's something wrong if I can't do that, as opposed to it just being the natural unfolding of cause and effect. So there's a couple minutes. There's not a lot of time, but any questions or thoughts about this? Yeah, you could wait for the mic.
I really liked the metaphor that you used about the mindfulness poking holes, essentially, in what we think is reality. I've been noticing that when I suffer, it's been just suffering. This feels awful. I'm trying to be mindful. I don't know. I just feel really awful. And to your point, what I'm noticing now is it's like you said, it's not really reality. It's like, oh, I feel anxious, but it's really like, no, there's a tightening in my throat.
Yes.
So there's like been a hole poked.
Yes.
And I'm trying to control this situation. I have an agenda. I have to get the kids to school on time. Everything's falling apart. Somebody's got to go to the bathroom last minute. Somebody can't tie their shoes. Somebody can't find their jacket. And I'm feeling anxious. But it's really the causes and conditions of all of these, what I think are obstacles.
Uh-huh.
But I can notice, tightness.
Yes.
So closing of the mind. And what's been really helpful for me is just to take a breath and stay.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell myself, stay,
mm-hmm.
stay, stay. And then I can notice the different things, like the contracting of the mind and the contracting of the throat. And it's not easy, but it's holes are starting to get broken.
Yes.
It's not just, it's awful and I don't know why.
Right,
now
yes.
I'm kind of like I'm seeing these. And it's just been really nice and helpful.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's kind of like, you know, what is actually happening here? You know, so much of the suffering we see has to do with our minds like propelling outward. And it's just like, well, what's actually happening here? Okay, kid needs to do that, kid needs to do that, kid needs to do that. This is the world, you know, out of control, basically. And the fact that I can't control it isn't your fault, you know. And the feeling that you have of anxiety arising, anxiety is happening. You know, that can be acknowledged without taking on, this is me, I am. I should be able to control, I should be able to navigate these conditions. That's a lot of where our suffering comes from. So yeah, seeing that the mindfulness begins to poke holes in the places where we're holding. And it's so amazing how the mind, in seeing that, begins to... It's like it's getting good information when we're mindful. It's getting information about... A good information about where the clinging and suffering are happening. And the mind itself begins to recognize, oh, this isn't necessary. You know, it's like we can't stop it ourselves, but the mindfulness begins to educate the mind about reality. Yeah. So thank you. And we need to stop. Thank you.